Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans.
We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
Johnny Horton singing The Battle of New Orleans in 1959. The song recalls the 1815 battle, well, eventually 1850, which was the last battle of the War of 1812, and which is notable for technically taking place after the War of 1812 ended. The participants didn't yet know a treaty ending the war had been signed. And so it is with the War of 1812. There were lots of quirks to the war and a lot of symbolism that resonates today. It was the war in which our nation's capital was burned. The symbol of Uncle Sam was first referenced. The Star-Spangled Banner was written. It was the last time the U.S. and Britain ever fought on opposite sides. And yet for all of these events, for all that went into this two-plus-year war, it remains, as today's guest writes, probably our most obscure war. We will seek to remedy that somewhat on today's program as we discuss the War of 1812, what it was all about, what led to it, the impact it had in its time, and what, if anything, about the war resonates today. Are there lessons we could learn from a 200-year-old conflict which was started for myriad and hazy reasons and which ended with an even hazier resolution? Can we draw parallels from the War of 1812 to modern-day warfare and geopolitics? Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. To talk these and other matters over, we are joined today by Donald Hickey, professor of history at Wayne State College and author of The War of 1812, A Forgotten Conflict. A newly expanded bicentennial edition of the book was recently released by University of Illinois Press. Donald Hickey, welcome to Focus.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. I have to admit up front, I knew little to nothing about the War of 1812 when I first picked up your book, and I am fairly sure in the American history textbooks I read in school that it was little more than maybe a paragraph or two. Something about maritime trade, land in Canada, Francis Scott Key, burning of the Capitol, and then kind of that was it. Is that pretty much the case for most Americans and most textbooks in school, or was I just not paying attention in class?
Oh, I think that's typical of textbooks. Three things that most Americans know about the war are the burning of Washington, and there it's only the public buildings, and secondly, the writing of the Star-Spangled Banner, and thirdly, the Battle of New Orleans, which, by the way, was not fought after the war was over.
Oh, it wasn't?
The treaty had been signed on December 24th, 1814, but the first clause of the treaty provided that hostilities would end only after both sides had ratified.
Ah, okay. So that explains it, because then both sides ratify in January
the British,
or February.
The British ratified on December 27th because they were pretty close to Ghent, in modern-day Belgium, where the treaty was signed. But the treaty didn't reach the U.S. until February 11th, and we didn't sign off on it until February 16th.
Ah, okay. So this is just, it's kind of like everything about the War of 1812 is quirky and different. This was one of the things that just as I was reading through the book, I'm like, well, okay, here's another thing that I didn't know had any connection to this war. There are so many little elements symbolism and oddities that I wonder if people just are aware of that.
Mostly, I don't think they are, and what they know ain't so. I've got another book, also by the University of Illinois Press, called "Don't Give Up the Ship: Myths of the War of 1812," in which I take direct aim at a lot of the misconceptions about the war.
Well, we'll get to that as well, but I think we should probably start with what actually led to the War of 1812. And while that's a simple question to ask, I gather from reading your book, it's a complicated answer.
Mostly, we went to war to force the British to give up certain maritime practices that they had adopted in their war against Napoleonic France. So this war was a byproduct of a larger war in Europe, a war that pitted England against France, and that was really the climax of over 100 years of Anglo-French warfare. The two leading causes were the Orders in Council, British executive orders that restricted our trade with the continent of Europe, and impressment, which was the Royal Navy's practice of stopping American merchant vessels on the high seas to remove seamen. Nominally, they only targeted British seamen, but thousands of American citizens got caught in the dragnet.
So why, scarcely a generation after winning our independence from England, would America want to find itself at war with England again?
Well, these were encroachments on our rights. The British were trying to win a war in Europe. We regarded these as a direct violation, these practices as a violation of our sovereignty. We tried to force the British to give up the practices with a series of trade restrictions, economic sanctions, but they just boomeranged on the United States, undermining American prosperity and cutting into government revenue. And by 1812, there was a young group of congressmen known as war hawks who were ready to up the ante and go to war against Great Britain to vindicate our rights.
There is this perception that maritime trade aside, there were also concerns that maybe the United States wanted to go to war as sort of a land grab to try and get land from, you know, what we characterize today as Canada.
Well, yet another persistent myth. The reason we invaded Canada is because we could not challenge the British on the high seas. The only place where Great Britain was vulnerable to us was in Canada. So our plan was to invade and conquer Canada and hold it for ransom on the maritime issues. And that helped promote the myth that the maritime issues were just a blind, that this was really a land grab. And that's a tough myth to disabuse people of, because nobody today understands the finer points of neutral rights in the age of sail in the early 19th century. But everybody can understand a land grab.
Okay, so then let's talk a little bit about some of those finer points. What exactly was it that the U.S. and, I guess, other nations in Europe, France, what were they ultimately warring with England over when it came to how trade got from one country to another across the sea?
Well, the bigger picture here is that Anglo-French War, really a series of wars that raged from 1689 to 1815. The Napoleonic Wars constituted sort of the last phase of this era of Anglo-French warfare, in which these two first-rate powers were seeking to world dominance, or seeking to dominate Europe and the wider world. And we got caught in the middle. We're a neutral power, a second-rate power. We traded extensively around the world and took advantage of the wartime conditions to make money. And both Great Britain and France were trying to deny each other the fruits of our neutral trade. And so that's where the problem arose.
I guess it's also important to underscore that when we talk about the United States, we are talking about a nation at this point that's 30 years old, that hasn't really established any longstanding history of just about anything, including how it trades, how its military exists, its structure. All of that is still sort of in the process of development to some degree, is it not?
It is, and I think one of the problems was the Jeffersonian Republicans, who were in charge of the nation's destinies after 1801, thought we could push these great powers around. But we couldn't. We were a second-rate power, and when great powers are at war, they're not going to risk losing that war, in order to appease a second-rate power. To put it another way, Great Britain and France would rather risk war with the United States than adopt policies that might undermine their war effort in Europe.
You mentioned the Jeffersonian Republicans, and they had pretty significant control of both houses of Congress, the presidency through this period. Talk to us a little bit about the two major political parties at the time, the Republicans and the Federalists, and what impact they had on the ultimate decision to go to war.
Well, the Federalists were the party that dominated the government in the 1790s. This was the party of Washington, John Adams, and Alexander Hamilton. They got voted out of office in 1801, and thereafter the Jeffersonian Republicans, dominated by the likes of Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and various other allies in the North, dominated the government. Basically, the Jeffersonian Republicans believed in small government, and they didn't like spending money on defense measures, even in a very dangerous world. They didn't like taxes. So they adopted a small government policy in an era in which I think we needed to devote more money to national defense.
Who were some of the key figures within the Jeffersonian Republicans in those few years leading up to 1812 and the war?
Well, Madison had become president in 1809. His Secretary of State was James Monroe, a future president. And the war hawks in Congress, that young group of congressmen, too young to remember the horrors of the last British War and thus willing to undertake another, were dominated by Henry Clay. He was a first-term congressman in late 1811, and yet he was elected to the largely ceremonial position of Speaker of the House, and he very quickly transformed that position into one of power and used his power as Speaker of the House by packing committees, controlling debate, and interpreting the rules to keep the war program on track so that we adopted a series of war preparations and then on June 18th went to war.
Who were some of the key figures then in Great Britain during and leading up to the war?
Probably the three dominant figures were the Prime Minister, Lord Liverpool, the Foreign Secretary, Lord Castlereagh, and the Duke of Wellington, who was in charge of military operations in the Spanish Peninsula in the Napoleonic Wars, but was consulted on major policy matters.
What were their perceptions of America's opinion about how these trade policies should exist?
Well, they felt they were fighting the war for Western civilization. And so they regarded this declaration of war by the United States as kind of a stab in the back. And before that, I think many people in the British Isles thought we were taking advantage of our position as a neutral to make a lot of money at their expense while they were sacrificing blood and treasure to hold back the French menace.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're discussing the War of 1812 with historian Donald Hickey, author of The War of 1812, A Forgotten Conflict. University of Illinois Press recently issued a bicentennial edition of the book. We welcome your questions and comments for Donald Hickey. Perhaps we can debunk some myths about the War of 1812. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. Those phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Why don't you walk us through the major battles, where the war was fought and what those contests really ultimately dealt with?
Well, this is pretty confusing, Craig. by my count, there were 10 theaters of operations in this war. It was a pretty diffuse war. Four on the northern frontier, the Canadian-American frontier, and then you've got the Chesapeake, which was a major theater for the British Navy. The British also occupied 100 miles of the main coast. That would be the sixth theater of operation. You've got Jackson's War against the Creeks in the southwest. That's number seven. The Gulf Coast, which culminated in the Battle of New Orleans. That's the eighth. You've got a theater around St. Louis, which we might call the St. Louis Theater of Operations, mostly small-scale Indian engagements. And then you've got a lot of warfare on the high seas. That would be the 10th theater. So you've got a really diffuse theater of diffuse war, and that not only made it tough for any single American commander, however able he might be, to carry the nation to victory, but it also really affected the way people remembered the war. Depending on where you live, your perceptions of what had happened might be very different.
Well, we've talked about the Americans, we've talked about the British, but we haven't really talked about Native Americans and their role in this war. It was not insignificant.
No. The Indians, mostly living in the United States, but also some in Canada, looked to Great Britain as an ally to hold back the American onslaught. Between 1803 and 1809, William Henry Harrison, who was governor of the Indiana Territory and our Indian agent in the Old Northwest, had imposed a series of increasingly dubious and doubtful treaties, land cession treaties, on the Northwest Indians. And by 1809, they had had enough. And so they were prepared to go to war against the United States, and they looked to their British friends to the north as allies. Now, the British didn't want these Indians to go to war, but they did want to retain them as allies if they got involved in the war. And so most of the Indians lined up with the British in the War of 1812.
There is this conventional wisdom, again, at least at the time, that one of the reasons, and you sort of alluded to this, that the U.S. wanted to fight, engage in a battle on land, was that they might have more success there, you know, in Canada, and use that to force the issue in terms of maritime trade rather than engage the British strictly in the sea, and that England would have the advantage when it came to naval battles in the Atlantic. Was that actually the case?
It was, although much to everyone's surprise, We did very badly on the northern frontier because, for a whole host of reasons, our military establishment was really in a sad state. We faced a determined and capable foe in the British regulars who were in Canada and their Indian allies. And the logistical problems of waging war on a distant frontier were very nearly insuperable. So we did very badly in what was supposed to be essentially what one Republican critic called a holiday campaign. We expected to march up to the Canadian frontier and be welcomed as liberators, and it simply didn't play out that way. By contrast, on the high seas, we won a series of single ship victories that were equally surprising. Now, those were of no strategic importance in the course of the war, but they did give a boost to American morale, especially in 1812, when we sorely needed it.
You mentioned the military establishment was in, as you call it, a sad state. Why was that?
The Republicans didn't want to put any money into the military establishment. And so it had been starved. West Point had just been established in 1802 and hadn't been around long enough to funnel a sufficient number of professional officers into the Corps and what into the service. And what the government did at the beginning of the war, it put in charge mostly a bunch of antiquated Revolutionary War generals who really had lost their taste for campaigning and for battle. They were long past their prime, and it took a couple of years for a younger generation of officers to emerge and take charge in the various theaters.
Did we have a well-established national military, or was it still sort of state to state?
Well, we did have a national army, a U.S. Army, but it was pretty small. We didn't pay enough, didn't pay the soldiers well enough, and the enlistment bounties weren't enough to attract very many people. So even when the army was increased in size, the enlistments always lagged behind need. And by the end of the war, the government was offering a huge bounty, $124 in cash and 320 acres in land. And I figure that conservatively is about a $30,000 enlistment bounty today. But that's what it took to get men to enlist in the Army, and then you had to train them. And that took a year or two, so we were always behind the curve on that score.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guest is historian Donald Hickey. He's author of The War of 1812, A Forgotten Conflict. University of Illinois Press recently issued a bicentennial edition of the book. We are discussing The War of 1812, and you can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. We are on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. And those phone numbers, again, are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we'll begin this morning with Mike in Effingham. Mike, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a general question. Your guest, I understand, is a historian. And that's the focus of this program. But history has got a great deal to contribute to this conversation, I think. And the horrendous behavior of our species on everything, including itself, and how and when, and I wonder if he could address the psychology and the psychiatric damage that has ensued in the last 15,000 years. I know that's broad, but in order to understand war, we have to understand why. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. You know, and actually that does kind of get into what I wanted to talk about anyway, which is whether there are parallels between the War of 1812 and geopolitics and warfare today. But I'll give you a chance to comment if you want on sort of the very grand scope that Mike just suggested, and then we'll get into some of those more specific ideas.
Well, I can't really comment. I don't really have a view on the overarching question that our caller asked. My one cautionary note here is that you have to be very careful not to compare different periods of history or different wars or different events, because conditions are never identical. What might work or be a sensible policy in one era might not work in another. And there's a perfect example in Europe. The Germans invaded Russia in 1914 and ultimately were very successful. They did it again in 1941 and were not. And if you go back further, in 1812, Napoleon was unsuccessful. So two out of three, you couldn't really predict how each one was going to come out because the circumstances were always different.
But are there, I'm wondering, character traits, certain conditions that seem to exist from one war to the next, or that maybe some parallels we can draw without saying, oh, we can necessarily learn for future conflicts strictly based off of what happened leading up to the War of 1812, but you've shared a few things already that sort of resonate today, things like the fact that most of the folks that were sort of pushing America towards war in 1812 were what you characterized as young war hawks who had not participated in the last war. And you mentioned that at one point during one land battle that they thought they would be welcomed as liberators. Well, that's familiar to conflicts today. Are there parallels to draw without saying, oh, this is a purely a lesson that must be learned?
Well, the one point I would make on that score is that 1812 was the norm. We sort of think of World War II as being the model. Everybody rallies around the flag, but that's really the exception. You look at the long history of American wars, from the American Revolution up to our recent wars in the Middle East, and typically they've been characterized by a fair amount of opposition. So what happened during the War of 1812, I think, was typical rather than exceptional.
Although it's hard to get a sense of how strong that opposition was, as you noted, politically anyway. The Republicans, the Jeffersonian Republicans, had pretty firm control. What was it, something like 75% of the seats in Congress at the time?
Yeah, that's about right. But take a look at the vote on the Declaration of War. It was 79-49 in the House of Representatives and 19-13 in the Senate. Every single Federalist voted against the war, and probably about 20% of the Republicans did as well. Now, if that vote was representative of public opinion at the time, and I think it's a fair guess that it was, that means that upwards of 40% of the American people opposed the decision to go to war.
How many people died during the War of 1812?
Well, that's a great question. The official battle casualties are about 2,200, but you lost in those days. In fact, in all our wars before World War II, we always lost more men to disease and to a lesser extent, accident. And I reckon total American deaths in the War of 1812 were about 20,000. And I thought I might have been a little high, but there's some guy working on this on the northern frontier, and he thinks I might be a little low. He thinks it might be more like 25,000 or 30,000. The problem is you had a 500,000 militia who were called out for either very short tours of duty. You might be called out during an alarm for a couple hours and then sent home, or for a month or 2 months or 3 months or even 6 months of service. And we just don't know how many of those citizen soldiers contracted a camp disease, went home and died, and would not qualify or not be counted. And there's no way of counting them, but really have to be considered war casualties.
You mentioned the fact that through the long lens of history, people have ascribed to different theories about why we got into the War of 1812, and some are myths to be debunked, some are not. Was there a sense of clear purpose to the war, to the people participating in it, and to the citizenry itself at the time?
I think most of those who supported the war did have a pretty clear idea of what they wanted to achieve. And also, I think it's worth pointing out, to some extent, the declaration of war was a kind of bluff. We have Republicans telling one another in their letters that the British aren't taking us seriously. They're not listening to us. And if we go to war, that will bring them to their senses and they will make concessions on the issues that are important to us. So there was actually a portion of the Republican Party, and it is sometimes called the Scarecrow faction, that hoped that no fighting would be necessary, that the mere declaration of war would achieve our war aims.
We're discussing the War of 1812 with Donald Hickey. He's a professor of history at Wayne State College and the author of The War of 1812, A Forgotten Conflict. University of Illinois Press recently issued a bicentennial edition of the book. We will talk more after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the War of 1812 with Donald Hickey, professor of history at Wayne State College. He's author of the book, The War of 1812, A Forgotten Conflict. University of Illinois Press recently issued a bicentennial edition of the book, and we welcome your questions and comments today at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Those phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Historically, we've seen wars lead to an economic boom. World War II was a key factor in our finally pulling out of the Great Depression. The military-industrial complex today, for better or worse, has a significant impact on our economy. How did the War of 1812 affect the U.S. economically?
Well, that was a war that really hurt us economically because we were at war with the one nation with a navy that could really put a stop to our trade. And understand that most Americans lived on the eastern seaboard in those days. I would say probably over half, maybe even 75% within 50 miles of the Atlantic Ocean. And to a greater or lesser extent, everybody's income was tied to the sea. You've got merchants and shipwrights and dock workers and seamen who are dependent on the sea. You've got farmers who need to export their produce to foreign markets. And then you've got all the people who simply did business with those farmers and merchants and maritime people. And if they weren't doing business, if they were out of money, then those cobblers or candle makers or the people who were dependent on them also suffered. So we were taking on the one nation that could really harm us, and the British ultimately established a naval blockade of our entire coast, and it not only largely put an end to our foreign trade, but also much of the coasting trade, because the ships could not safely navigate along the coast. So this is a war that sharply cut into American prosperity, and since government revenue was dependent on trade, a government revenue could not stay up with the needs of the war. And the upshot of this was the government became insolvent in 1814 and in November actually defaulted on the national debt. The only time that has happened since Hamilton put our financial house in order in the early 1790s.
When we consider the fact that economically this put America at risk, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line but wanted to know if you could list some of the benefits of the war for the United States. Were there benefits?
Well, there were a lot of consequences, and I guess you could call some of them favorable benefits. But if you're just talking economically, manufacturers did well because they didn't have to compete with the British during the war. And those who had government contracts, there were a lot in the middle states, particularly in and around Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and New York, and also in the West, who sold a lot of goods and commodities to the government and did very well during the war. But in New England and the South, I think mostly they were worse off during the war than they were before or after the contest.
Other than economically, what were some of the consequences, benefits, or otherwise?
Well, those are profound and important, and I think you have to measure all your wars on the basis of their consequences. And these are largely underappreciated, I think. In a broad sense, the war vindicated American sovereignty. It boosted our self-confidence and patriotism and earned us a greater respect overseas. Our victory in the two Indian Wars associated with the War of 1812 in the Old Northwest and the Old Southwest opened the door to westward expansion. And beyond that, we acquired a series of symbols and sayings that helped us better understand who we were as a nation and where we were headed. Most notably, Oliver H. Perry's After Action Report, "We've met the enemy and they are ours," or the words of Captain James Lawrence as his ship, the USS Chesapeake, was being overrun by the British, "Don't give up the ship," which later became the motto of the U.S. Navy. Plus, we emerged from the war with a renewed respect for the national flag, largely because of the Fort McHenry bombardment, also with what ultimately became the national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner, and with the USS Constitution, probably our most famous warship. And even the Kentucky Rifle emerged from the war with, I think, a much inflated reputation as a kind of iconic shoulder arm that had been a real game changer in the war, although I don't really think it was.
You also wrote the first references to Uncle Sam started to percolate during this time.
Yeah, it used to be thought that the first references were in the spring of 1813, but I found a newspaper reference in late 1812. And they didn't have the image of Uncle Sam that we have today. Those come from the cartoons of Thomas Nast in Harper's Weekly in the 1870s. But simply the idea that as a nickname for the U.S. government or the Army or the nation, Uncle Sam was that nickname.
So how did the war ultimately end?
Well, that's a great question, and that's contested ground, and that's another reason it's a forgotten conflict. There's an old saw that everyone's happy with the outcome. Americans are happy because they think they won. The Canadians are happier because they know they won, and the British are happiest of all because they've forgotten all about it. And I think except for ignoring the Indians, who are the biggest losers, that's a fair assessment.
When you say Great Britain forgot all about it, you get the impression in reading your book that they saw this as almost, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but almost like a secondary conflict. Like the issue really was, no, we're at war with France, and we got to deal with that, and this is annoying, and we will address it. But in the grand scheme of things, what happens during this war is not as important as this bigger war.
That assessment is dead on. This was a minor theater of operations to them in a much larger and more significant war that was being waged in Europe. And they had no particular reason to remember this war, especially after they were defeated so decisively at New Orleans. And so what the British chose to remember, the British public, was their great victories in the Napoleonic Wars. Trafalgar in 1805, and then Waterloo, which comes about 6 months after New Orleans.
What did the Treaty of Ghent say, the treaty which ultimately, once ratified, ended the conflict?
The Treaty of Ghent provided for returning to the status quo ante bellum, which means both sides agreed to give up all territory. And that, and the fact that it appeared to end in a military draw on the battlefield, I think has most scholars concluding that the war ended in a draw. But I don't see it that way. We declared war to achieve certain war aims. Those maritime issues were not even mentioned in the peace treaty, so it looks to me like we lost the war.
So it didn't resolve the issues which prompted war in the first place.
No. And those issues went away because the Napoleonic Wars ended in 1815. But there would have been nothing to stop the British if that European war had resumed from impressing from our ships or issuing new orders in council that regulated our trade.
Was there anyone arguing back in 1810, 11, 12, just hang in there, this war in Europe will end and then all of this will be moot?
Yes. Actually, on the eve of war, there was a Virginia Federalist named Daniel Sheffy who made a great comment on the floor of Congress, something to the effect of, we have considered ourselves of too much weight in the scale of nations. We have imagined that things beyond our control were things that we could control, and really they weren't. And I think that was really the Federalist message, that we just had to ride out this storm, that these encroachments would end when the wars in Europe ended, and our best tact was simply to put up with these encroachments and take advantage of our opportunities to trade as they appeared and simply live with the downside of this war-torn world.
Is that maybe a long-view lesson that can be learned from this and other wars, that if there are circumstances that you find untenable to the degree where you want to go to war over them, maybe you could wait a little bit and they change?
Well, it depends on who you are.
Yeah.
And what the circumstances are. But I wouldn't use that as sort of a general rule for swearing off war. But you have to evaluate each international situation and your own strengths and weaknesses at the time, because every case is going to be different.
And certainly there are degrees to which some things are untenable right now, this moment, and then there are other things that maybe are policies that you don't necessarily agree with. There's a difference between the two.
Yes. And you also have to weigh the consequences of not acting. In our current situation, you have to decide, well, can I live with a nuclear Iran? Is that something that the United States can live with? And maybe that'll govern how you feel about doing something about it.
Let's take another call. We have Fred on the line from Urbana. Hi, Fred.
Good morning. For the author, I have a question and then a couple of comments about Illinois. My question is, did you use any of the writings of Theodore Roosevelt as a source for your book?
I did. Theodore Roosevelt wrote a two-volume naval history of the War of 1812 in the 1880s and then made some revisions on it over the next 20 years or so. And at least until very recently, that was the best naval history of the war. And it's still very, very helpful. Roosevelt didn't have access to all the primary sources we have access today, but he really made a serious effort to be fair-minded in assessing what happened in the war at sea. So I think it's still a very useful account of the naval war.
To bring it back to Illinois, there's a new book out by Keating called Up from Indian Country, and it's about a brief Indian war in and around Chicago and Fort Dearborn that took place in 1812.
Yeah, there are actually two good recent books from the University of Illinois Press that bear on the War of 1812. There's Keating's book, which is, I think, essentially an attempt to write an early history of Chicago. So she looks at the Fort Dearborn massacre in some detail.
Yes.
And then there's a wonderful book on Illinois in the War of 1812 by a former federal prosecutor named Gillam Ferguson. And that's just a wonderful account of much of the warfare around here, much of it which took place in what I would call the St. Louis Theater of Operations. And it's just very illuminating.
And also, I'm from Western Illinois, and I recall that, McDonough County and its county seat, Macomb, are named after U.S. military leaders of that war, and that the western counties were open to former soldiers with land deeds for new acreage that they could either settle on or sell.
Okay, those were the military land warrants. So when you signed up, you were promised, at least at the end of the war, 320 acres, and you got that in the form of a federal land warrant after the war was over and you'd been properly mustered out. Now, I think a lot of people sold those land warrants to middlemen. We might call them speculators, but essentially they were middlemen, and then they sold them to people who were eager to migrate into places like Western Illinois.
Well, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. We have a follow-up question from Josh via email about these land warrants. He asks, was this a federal grant or reserved for Illinois veterans? Was this a common practice for other states and territories?
Mostly by this time, the revolution had been different. The states had issued a lot of promises to give those serving land. But in this war, these are all federal land grants.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your question or comment about the War of 1812. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Those phone numbers again, 333-WILL or toll-free 800-222-WILL. We started off the hour talking about the fact that there are some misconceptions about the War of 1812, and we've talked about a couple of them. What are some others that you commonly hear?
Well, the ones that I think I fight the most in my the Q&A in my public lectures, and I've got one that's actually on the myths of the War of 1812. It's called What We Know That Ain't So, Myths of the War of 1812.
Okay.
The first is what caused the war. People just don't want to give up the Canadian thesis that this was a land grab. The other is that we won the war because we beat the British at New Orleans, or that battle was fought after the war was over, neither of which I think is true. We also have some myths about how well the Army and the Navy performed, how important those naval victories were. They really were strategically unimportant, and our Army really didn't perform very well until well into 1813, and then especially in 1814. The reputation of the Kentucky Rifle also, I think, is one I have to deal with. in these Q&A periods.
What about the Kentucky Rifle?
Well, the British believed every time they took heavy fire that it was a bunch of people armed with these long rifles, which had a range of about 300 yards, rather than the more typical 100 and 150 yards of the smoothbore musket. And Westerners did bring some of those weapons into the field, and this myth developed that that's how we defeated the British in this war, because we had superior weapons at places like the Battle of the Thames in 1813 or the Battle of New Orleans in 1815. And there were some long rifles involved in those engagements, but mostly this was a war fought with old-fashioned 18th-century smoothbore muskets.
You mentioned the Battle of New Orleans, and I certainly demonstrated my own confusion over it at the beginning of our conversation. I wonder how much of that lasting confusion or perception that it somehow had an impact on the end of the war or that it took place after the war ended, all of that, how much that has to do with when word arrived in Washington about the Battle of New Orleans and when word arrived in Washington about the treaty.
Well, I think that's probably true. News of the Battle of New Orleans arrived in Washington, I think it was about 10 days before news of the treaty. And there was a similar pattern all over the eastern seaboard. And it didn't take people long, maybe 6 months, a year, before they concluded that the Battle of New Orleans had led to the peace treaty. So we have Niles Register, the leading Republican magazine, in 1816, asserting, and I'm quoting, "We did virtually dictate the Treaty of Ghent to the British." Well, that just ain't so.
We have just a few minutes left. I want to see if we can get in a couple more calls. So I'll ask our callers and our guests to be brief in your questions and response. We'll go to David in Urbana. Hi, David.
Hello. Follow-up question on the musket versus the rifle. The musket actually wasn't that bad a military weapon, was it? Because it could be loaded much more rapidly than a rifle. And therefore, the firepower, in a sense, at close-range fighting in most was greater for the musket.
Well, there was much to be said for the musket, and that's part of the sort of inflated reputation of the rifle, that it might lead someone to believe these muskets were not good weapons, but they were. And the British certainly believed the muskets could be loaded faster, and so they never had a rifle company that acted alone. They always wanted it with some more conventional infantry armed with muskets because they thought it would take longer to load those rifles, and they may have been right. Certainly the rifles were more likely to foul because they had a grooved barrel and the powder would get packed in those grooved barrels, and then the weapons weren't very effective. And I know some people with rifles thought they needed two different kinds of powder, a fine grade and also a coarser grade for the barrel, fine grade for the upper part of the rifle.
Hmm.
So the rifle, it took a long time for the rifle to catch on. It really wasn't until the Civil War that it became the standard weapon of issue,
and
that's in part because the musket was considered more reliable.
Those were breech-loading rifles, too.
Not until well into the war.
Well, that's true.
Mm-hmm. They were muzzle-loading.
But they were shorter-barreled.
That may be.
The rifle really was a hunting weapon in the 1820s or earlier.
Correct. Although there were rifle units in the armies of Europe that went back to the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
They understood these weapons had because of their superior range, they did have a use on the battlefield. But they simply didn't fully appreciate how effective they might be.
Well, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Charles in Champaign. Hi, Charles.
Yes, sir. How are you doing? Thank you for having me today.
Sure.
I was curious as to, did the War of 1812 have any impact into the expansion of slavery in Western states?
Well, not that I can tell. It did give a boost to American expansion in the Southwest. By virtue of the treaty that Jackson imposed on the Creeks in 1814, they had to surrender 22 million acres of land. And just an absolutely staggering amount of land was transferred to the United States. And that did open the door to Southern expansion and thus the expansion of Southern slavery. But I think that was going to happen anyway, and I don't think I would say the war promoted the expansion of slavery. It promoted American expansion generally, and in the South, that meant the expansion of slavery.
Why do you think the War of 1812 is generally not remembered as viscerally as America's other wars?
Well, I attribute this to several things. Number one, the obscurity of the causes. Number two, the confusing conduct, all those theaters of operation. Number three, the outcome, which is not altogether clear. And then number four, there's the Civil War. People commemorated the War of 1812, and they remembered it for about 30 years after the war. And people who came back from the Mexican War also remembered that war. In fact, you have officers in the Mexican War when they come back from that war, and this includes Grant and Lee. They're telling one another they have just had the experience of a lifetime. They didn't know what lay on the horizon. And when the Civil War erupted in 1861, it was of such monumental proportions and consequences that it very quickly swept these two other earlier wars deep into the recesses of the public memory.
I understand you first became interested in the War of 1812 when you were a grad student here at the U of I.
Correct.
How did you come to be interested in this war?
Well, I was intrigued by Federalist opposition because I thought it was well-advised. It seemed to me the decision to go to war had been a mistake, and we didn't achieve our war aims, and the Federalists predicted this. So it seemed to me they had a pretty good handle. Their policies were, I thought, wiser. And I was intrigued by the fact that many of my colleagues and many of the faculty I knew were dead set against the war in Vietnam, which was then underway, but they had no objections to the War of 1812. They were totally uncritical in accepting sort of the Jeffersonian and Madisonian view of the war. And that intrigued me. And so I wrote my senior honors thesis on New England's opposition to the war, and then my PhD dissertation on Federalist opposition. And then years later, after I'd done some spade work and a lot of articles, I produced A Forgotten Conflict, which is an overview of the war.
Was this sort of the last hurrah for the Federalists?
It was. The party, for a variety of reasons, was out of touch with the American people. And they were in a period of decline from 1800 on, but they were revived first by the embargo and the other trade restrictions, which boomeranged on the United States, and then by the War of 1812. You'll look at elections during the War of 1812, Federalists actually make gains. But opposing the war may have been popular during the war, but once it was over, it became a real liability. And the taint of that opposition drove the Federalist Party into oblivion. It was headed in that direction anyway, but after the war was over, I think their position on the war quickened that drift.
It's sort of hard to imagine today we have two parties that have been pretty strong for a pretty long time. To imagine one major political party just sort of quietly frittering away.
Well, this happened several times in our history. We've been through three or four major party systems, but you're quite right. The two parties we have today have been the major parties since the mid-1850s. The Democratic Party of today was the Jeffersonian Republican Party that was founded in the 1790s, and our modern Republican Party was founded as an anti-slavery party in the wake of the Kansas-Nebraska Act in the 1850s.
So I guess we can expect they'll be around for a little while longer yet.
It sure looks that way.
Donald R. Hickey is a professor of history at Wayne State College. He's the author of The War of 1812, A Forgotten Conflict. A bicentennial edition of his book is now available, published by University of Illinois Press. Donald Hickey, thanks so much for talking with us.
You bet. My pleasure.
And we welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. Remember, if you know anybody who might enjoy hearing Focus but lives outside of our listening area, let them know we stream this program each day at will.illinois.edu. You can also listen back to past programs there. Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up, again, just visit the Focus page of our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, an elementary school in Urbana is piloting a dual language program, teaching kindergarten classes in Spanish as well as English. But do foreign language classes have a place in elementary schools? program has been generally accepted by parents, and participating students have been outperforming educator expectations. On tomorrow's program, we will talk about language and education and the potential benefits of young children learning to speak more than one language, in some cases very young children, kindergarten, first grade. We'll talk with Yuridichi Bauer, an associate professor of curriculum and instruction at the University of Illinois, about how we think the brain switches between one language to another and if learning more than one language at the same time positively or negatively affects a child's proficiency in one or the other. We'll also dig into what impact that has on learning in general as well. We'll also talk with Joseph Wiemelt, interim principal of Urbana High School. That's on tomorrow's program. Today's show is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft's our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.